Today is June 24th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I declared war against the Mac Geek Gab, and they went from a 10-vote lead to a 20-vote lead.
Sheesh.
I'm Ricky Spiro. Hey, everybody. So there's 1 week left in June, which means this is the last show during which I'll harass you to click on that Podcast Alley link in the show notes and vote for the show, vote for the roundup. Now, last week, I challenged the Mac Geek Gab to a voting battle at Podcast Alley, and all of you responded, which is terrific. As I'm recording, we're within just a few votes of the top 100, which is totally cool. But the Geek Gab, our adversaries in this adventure, is climbing the ranks faster than we are. So we still got some work to do this last week. Hey, come on, let's do it. Let's get, 20, 30, let's get 40 more votes. Let's double the number of votes that we got in this last week. Come on, let's get them. Hey, everybody, if you want to get the full story on anything I talk about in this show, you can visit the show notes over at macobserver.com/roundup. That's also where we've got the voting link. But you all already knew that. Or hey, maybe you didn't already know that. I don't know. Maybe this is your first time listening to the show. If so, welcome to the Weekly Roundup. Little bit loopy today, as you may be able to tell. I haven't got a unifying theme for this week's show. There were developments over a whole bunch of scattered stories, so we're going to get through as much of it as we can in the time we have. This week, also, Jeff Gamet returns to the Context Machine, so I'm looking forward to his thoughts on each of these stories. Let's begin with Apple Computer, which is well known for the secrecy surrounding its product roadmap. It's also known for having a lousy relationship with IT departments in businesses around the world. Now imagine if I told you that those two facts aren't as separate as they might seem. The company recently acknowledged the frustration that secrecy creates for corporate IT buyers. Apple officials discussed the issue with IT managers and developers at a meeting in Sydney, Australia on Monday. Most corporate buyers want to plan 2 to 3 years out, but that's difficult to do since Apple typically doesn't offer product information in advance. Other computer vendors, however, provide information that makes it easier for buyers and consultants to predict company roadmaps. Currently, Apple's best answer to the problem is the Worldwide Developer Conference. The annual event for developers and IT administrators offers a glimpse into Apple's grand plan. Despite the valuable information Apple provides at WWDC, not every administrator can attend. The four-day event is held once a year in San Francisco, and passes range from $1,500 or $1,600 all the way up to $3,500 US. Most of the information attendees receive also can't be shared, or at least much of it can't be shared with other people either, since portions of the event are protected by non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs. Now, here's a story that is just a sign of the times. iPodMyBaby.com on Monday announced that it has become iPopMyBaby.com as a result of a letter from Apple asking the company to change its URL because the term iPod is protected by trademark. The site launched last August and has sold over 10,000 iPod-themed one-piece baby outfits and t-shirts since then. The company plans to expand its offerings beyond iPod-themed baby clothes, by the way. And here's a little business news. ASUS Tech Computer and Quanta Computer, Apple's laptop manufacturers in the Far East, expect to ship 2.3 million laptops to the company by the end of the year. 2.3 million. Is that a lot? I don't know. I'll ask Jeff in just a minute. And even though this is more of a product roundup type of announcement thing that I'd normally do at the end of the show, I do want to talk to Jeff about GarageGame's new Torque Game Builder, which was released on Wednesday. Torque Game Builder is a video game development application for novice and advanced game designers. The game design environment features animated sprites, flexible tiles, a special effects system, state-of-the-art collisions, real-world physics, and hardware-accelerated 2D rendering, interface design tools, level building, package creation, and other such things involved in game development. A pro version is also available, which includes the engine code, editor source code, and the ability to use plugins, and the ability to convert scripts into compiled code. Commercial customers can purchase Torque Game Builder for $495 and Torque Game Builder Pro for $1,250. Independent developers and hobbyists get a discount. The standard version is $100. The pro version is $495. And since the editors at TMO are always up for a good hack, we were pleased when we stumbled across an autoblog story about someone that installed a Mac Mini in their Toyota Prius. Now, we've all seen the aquarium made out of an old Mac and the litter box made out of an LC. I don't know. We've all seen plenty of hacks that are basically useless. This one is actually quite extraordinary and quite well done. Jeremy Kuznets is his name, a systems architect from Leesburg, Virginia, managed to fit an Intel-based Mac Mini into the car's center instrument console and even reprogrammed the built-in touch-sensitive display to work as an interface for the computer. That's cool. I mean, come on, that's cool. With a little help from Front Row, he has easy access to his music library, and his daughter can watch movies on the road. He's not allowed. He's driving. You can see what it took to merge the car and the computer at the gentleman's website. Now, this is totally sweet and I think actually quite useful. Again, I'll talk to Jeff about it in a second. And finally, in the context, machine fodder, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco on Monday signed into law a bill that would fine retailers and potentially even imprison them for selling violent video games to minors. On Wednesday, the Entertainment Software Association, or the ESA, filed suit in federal court, which led a judge to put a temporary injunction on enforcing the new law. And finally, before we move on, just a quick update on the type of story that we were doing last week about Apple and sweatshop labor. Apple has announced that it is launching an investigation into the labor practices at Foxconn in the Far East. So, back on the show once again. Really glad to have you back. Jeff Gamet, morning editor of the Mac Observer. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. As always, it's great to be here.
Now, we were just talking about this before we started recording. You had something very exciting happen today. You just received something in the mail. You want to tell everybody what's going on here?
Sure. I just received a copy of my new book that comes out next week, The Designer's Guide to Mac OS X.
The Designer's Guide. So designer of what?
It's focused towards graphic designers and creative professionals, but don't let that stop you from buying it. There's a lot of really good info in there for everyone.
For everybody. Everybody
That's
needs
right.
a copy of this book.
Absolutely.
Oh, very cool. Congratulations. And you said that's coming out on shelves.
It'll be on the 26th, so I believe that's next Tuesday.
Well, that's great news. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Let's get underway here. I wanted to start with a story. This week, apparently an Apple exec admitted that the company's secrecy, and the company's secrecy is something that it holds very dear, and Steve Jobs has been public about that, but said that the secrecy that Apple has surrounding its products has made it harder for Apple to make any inroads into IT. So let's push that comment a little bit further. Does secrecy make Apple incompatible fundamentally with big business, or is it really that it just makes it a little bit harder, it's another challenge, or is that really something that no one's ever going to be able to get around, the fact that Apple keeps its product roadmap secret?
It is a problem for Apple. And it's a big problem because so many of the big corporations that are buying computers are buying them the way they always have, which is based on being able to get advanced information from these beige box PC manufacturers and Intel, AMD companies like that. Apple doesn't give them that info. That's a problem. So now there's the Worldwide Developers Conference, and if these companies send their IT staff to the Developers Conference, they do get a lot of important information, and they have access to information 18, 24 months in advance, which is great. That's exactly what they need. But on the other hand, not a lot of companies want to spend $1,500 to send someone to San Francisco just so they can see what's potentially coming down the road.
Now, when we hear they learn about what's coming down the pike, does that mean that Apple, for example, sat them down and said, all right, in 6 months we're going to release a new music player that's based on the FireWire bus and has an internal hard drive, and we're going to call it the iPod, and it's going to look like this, and it's going to have a scroll wheel? I mean, do they sit down and do they really just explain their product roadmap the way you'd expect any other company to do, or is there still a game that they play? Do you have any idea?
Well, not having been to the Developers Conference myself, I will have to speculate. However, had I been to the conference, odds are whatever it is that they would tell me would be covered by a non-disclosure agreement, so we couldn't talk about it anyhow. Luckily, that hasn't happened, so I can just talk until I drop. No, I believe what they're more likely doing is giving the developers and IT departments kind of a conceptual overview. This is the direction we're heading type of thing. And the one thing they do have that's really concrete, they walk away with a copy of the next version of OS X. So they can sit down and start playing with the operating system, and you can certainly glean a lot of what Apple has in mind just based on that.
And I suppose it's also worth pointing out, for all of this discussion of secrecy, the fact is there's not that much information that Apple keeps secret. I mean, how many things did it do that, I mean, it's compulsively secret about every aspect of its business. But if you ask yourself, what bits of information could they have given companies about, for example, when their professional computers, when the replacement for the Power Mac is going to come out? Presumably, they've told at least some of their corporate clients, yeah, we're going to have a pro desktop Mac, and it's going to come out around this time of the year, the same way any other hardware manufacturer does. But to the consumer culture, or to the Apple watchers out there, it might seem like this really closely guarded secret, when in fact the way they would discuss it with big business is, hey, we're going to update our Pro Macs. They're going to have Intel processors in them. They're coming out in August.
You know, I don't know if they're that straightforward with all of their customers. However, it wouldn't surprise me if there are a few big companies that know pretty much what's going to happen. And some of them probably have early release equipment that they're playing with potentially even right now.
And of course, it's only reasonable that Apple would do that in order to seed its products, in order to test its products in the marketplace before it releases them.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot about Apple's roadmap that you can figure out on your own if you're in the industry. For example, if you look at what Intel's roadmap is and when they're releasing products, and then look at when the Worldwide Developers Conference is happening this year, okay, you put the pieces together and you can pretty much say we're going to see a pro-level replacement for the Power Mac G5 in August.
Fair enough. Now, switching gears, quick question. Why are all these iPod sites changing their name?
It's a fad. It'll pass.
Yeah, there's no brand cachet to the iPod. It's just a word that people happen to stumble on and they'll move.
Oh, yes. Okay, Apple is actually being very protective of the iPod moniker. And so websites and other companies that are using the word iPod in their name, Apple is going after many of them.
Now, it's worth asking, is there any reason to believe that this really hurts Apple, that there are sites out there with iPod in the name?
On one hand, no. On the other hand, yes. How's that for a vague answer? No, a lot of the sites that have been using the word iPod in their name, it's not a big deal because of the way they're using it. Now, for other sites, it's kind of a problem because it looks as if their site becomes or is part of Apple. And you see that a lot with product sites. And a lot of the products that have had iPod in their name, they've had to take that out. And a lot of that's because it makes it look like that's a product that Apple either makes or endorses. And it also dilutes the brand. And so Apple's in a position where they pretty much have to be doing that if they want to protect that trademark on the word iPod.
And if they want everyone to associate the word iPod with their players, rather than, for example, the way people treat the brand name Kleenex.
Yes, exactly.
And I guess it's also worth pointing out, if anyone's been wondering about why people haven't changed the word Mac, that genie's kind of out of the bottle, right? I mean, they were Mac World, Mac Observer, Mac Central, Mac everything. Everything with Mac in the name, it's kind of that ship has sailed. There have been sites, names, whatever, with Mac in them for so long, Apple kind of can't undo that right now.
That's exactly right. Now, they are very protective of the term Apple, and that's one that they do watch really close also.
And again, switching gears, Apple is apparently expected to ship 2.3 million laptops by year end. Is that a big number? Is that a small number? Can you help us put that in context?
For Apple, that's a really good thing. For some other computer manufacturers, that would be a really good thing. For Dell and HP, not so much. They're pushing a lot more computers out the door right now than anyone else. But if you look at what Apple's doing in relation to what they've done in the past, this is a really great thing. And it looks like they're on an upward swing for Mac sales, too.
And can you, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I don't suppose you have any numbers handy on the kind of laptop sales that Dell puts up or the ones that Apple's put up in the past.
Well, I was about to say, by coincidence, I actually have those numbers here in front of me. And apparently I don't. So I'm sorry, I can't give you those numbers right now.
Well, although fair enough.
I do know some of the statistics that they're looking at, though. Okay, if you look at what Apple's market share is right now, that's considered to be like 2.5% of the overall PC market. Mm-hmm. If they were to go up 0.5% to 3%, that would be like a 10% increase to the bottom line for earnings per share for all their shareholders. And if they could go up to 3.5%, okay, that's over 16% increase for the earnings per share. And that's a pretty significant percentage right there.
And that gets us into the territory, the whole concept of building market share and how for Apple watchers, for anyone on Wall Street, for any Apple shareholder, the idea of building market share, Apple doesn't need to get a 10%, 20% market share before it really changes the business. It'll be earning a lot more money if it puts up fractions of a percent of increase in market share, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And keep in mind that even though Apple only needs to have these small fractional increases to see massive increases in their bottom line, it doesn't mean they're doing poorly. Apple rakes in money by the bucket load. Wow, how is that for mixing up a bunch of metaphors?
Well, and if people are wondering for the explanation on that, one of the issues here, and maybe you can help flesh this out, but I understand that Apple has much better gross margins. On every dollar that they spend to build equipment or to write software, they get a better return than other manufacturers like Dell, who are selling at the lowest possible price, and therefore their margins are pushed really tightly.
That's absolutely right. Yes.
All right, so let's move on. I want to talk a little bit about this Torque game engine. Now, this is kind of off on a tangent from the kind of stuff that we normally talk about, but it is an interesting thing. What's the idea behind this game engine, the Torque Game Builder?
What Torque is doing is releasing a product that allows the average programmer or beginning programmer to develop professional quality video games. So they're taking tools that and concepts that previously have been only for the realm of the advanced programmer and putting it in the hands of the casual programmer. So what that means is that someone even like me could sit down with their new software game development system and probably have a game written and compiled and ready to go for Mac OS, Windows, PSP, Xbox in a relatively short amount of time. And for an expert programmer, they can start banging out really good games really fast.
Now, when we say commercially ready or commercially viable games, I mean, what seriously is are these really things that you could sell in a retail store?
Realistically, whatever I would create, no, not so much. But for someone that really knows what they're doing, sure, I don't see any reason why they couldn't create a game, turn around and package it and ship it off to the Apple Store and sell it.
And that's because my understanding is this is running on all of the open standards, all of the open graphics standards and other things for OpenGL and 3D rendering and all that full quality stuff. So it's kind of like, you know, the transitions that are built into Keynote, for example. Those are, as Steve Jobs is fond of saying, they're professional quality or cinematic quality transitions. Same thing here. The engine itself is built on industry standards, professional standards.
Yes, and actually they have two levels of the software development suite. And if you go to the pro level, you can actually take other modules or programming plugins that people have made, add them in, and extend the ability that you have with this application.
So it's kind of like an open source game developing community, only it's not quite open source because not everything is shared. You have to pay to, you kind of buy into this community of code sharing.
Exactly. Yes.
Let's stay on the topic of games for a minute. Now moving on to violent video games. This has always been one of my pet news stories. I find it fascinating when this discussion really gets going. Apparently, Louisiana passed this legislation that the governor recently signed into law that criminalizes the sale of violent games, that I assume games rated M for mature, to minors. So we have mandated standards for movies. Why shouldn't we have them for games?
You know, I think this law sucks. I'm sorry. This my feeling is having a law like this is, in essence, letting the government limit the freedom of speech of the game developers. I think it's totally appropriate to have some sort of warning on a game so that you know when you go into a store expecting to get some fun little My Favorite Pony game for your five-year-old girl, that's what you're going to get, and you're not going home with the latest first-person shooter where when the bomb goes off inside the guy, the guts actually slide down the inside of your screen. Although a great effect, maybe not appropriate for a five-year-old. Yeah, I think this is just flat-out wrong, and I'm really glad that there's an injunction right now preventing the law from being enforced.
Now, I was pushing the point here. Alternatively, I could have asked the question, given that voluntary standards exist for games, why do we need mandatory standards for movies? I mean, are these, I suppose the neutral way to ask this question is there a conflict, a kind of an ethical incompatibility with having voluntary standards for games and having mandatory standards for movies. Should the two be treated the same way? Should we expect the same thing from the regulations that relate to both? Or should we really treat these two things differently?
I don't think we need to treat them differently. And now, I might be wrong, and if I am, I'm sure I'll get an email from at least one person. But I was under the impression that the rating standards for the movie industry was voluntary also. However, if you fail to get a rating for your movie, no theater would play it. So in that respect, it would be mandatory if you actually want to make money off your movie.
Ah, well, in that case, I was wrong, and I'm sure someone will send me an email.
Either way, one of us is going to get an email.
Fair enough.
So, but, you know, that's how it should be. I think it should be the voluntary standard, do the self-policing, let the industry take care of itself. And if I'm right and it's the voluntary thing for the movies, okay, it's been working fine for years. And why not let it work that way for the video games too? The one place where it is mandatory is for comic books. And so now you see a lot of weird stuff that's developed over the years in that industry. And it's a perfect example of why we should let the industry police itself, at least these industries.
Now, do you think that there's any, just very briefly, do you think there's any weight to the argument that runs something like this? Video games are interactive, therefore they're more immersive, and therefore they're more likely to affect the people that get involved with them than movies are. Movies, you show up, you watch it for 2 hours, and you leave. A video game can be an incredibly immersive experience. So is there any reason to treat them with a more delicate touch than we do with movies, to treat them as more dangerous in a sense?
I must be going to better movies than you, because I get totally immersed in the ones I go to see. No, I don't think we need to look at it that way, although I'm sure that there's plenty of people that would be happy to send me an email saying otherwise. I think we should let the video game industry self-police itself, just like the movie industry is. And if you look at where both these industries are going, they're already very tightly intertwined, so it would be very easy to have kind of a common rating system between the two. I mean, many video games now are developed at the same time, if not before, the movie that they represent.
All right, and just to wrap up today, any final comments on Mac Hacks? I saw two good ones myself, one of which I think was run at TMO. The Prius Mini, the Mac Mini inside of a Prius, which actually, I mean, usually you see a hack and you say, okay, that's kind of funny. Like the thing, the MacBooks or the with the lightsaber sounds and the swinging your computer around the room so that you can fight other people. I mean, that's kind of amusing, but then you say, why did someone ever spend the time to do that?
Right.
The Mac Mini and the Prius actually looks like a pretty sweet setup. I mean, that seems like a really good idea.
You know, that's cool enough that it makes you want to go out and buy a Prius just to do it.
A Prius and a Mini. The only thing about the interface that I looked at and said, that's kind of silly. The scrolling seems a little weird. But everything else, I mean, you get front row up there. You tap on the thing that you want. It pops up. You can watch movies. I mean, it's brilliant.
You know, I think the thing with the scrolling, for those of you playing at home that don't know about the scrolling thing, the interface for the Mac Mini in the car is actually using the touch screen that's built into the Prius. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's where the issue with scrolling comes in. It just didn't seem to work right when the guy hacked the code for the interface. But for everything else, you know, front row and all of that, yeah, that's just stellar. You can just sit there and tap on an icon and play your movie, listen to your music, whatever you want to do. Yeah. I think it's brilliant.
So, hey, maybe it'll get picked up by Apple. Who knows?
That would be great.
The newest collaboration. Front row of the car.
Perfect.
All right, I think that's going to do it for this week. Jeff, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
As always, if you have questions or thoughts about the news, feel free to send them to me. The email is roundup@macobserver.com. And as usual, we'll finish up with a quick product roundup. NearTime announced the immediate availability of its internet-based business collaboration service on Tuesday. The cross-platform service lets businesses and organizations share calendars, documents, and other information privately, as well as publish content to the web. Monthly subscription plans range from $4.95 to $200. That's $4.95 up to $200. 22 Moo recently introduced its VGSD glasses, which connect to a video iPod, video game console, or other device with AV outputs, and give the wearer the impression that they're watching a 35-inch TV from 6 feet away. It's set to ship next month and costs $250 US. Opera Software on Tuesday released Opera 9, the latest version of its web browser for Mac, Windows, and Linux. It's a free download. Doghouse Electronics on Wednesday introduced Rover TV, a portable device that records audio and video to an SD flash memory card, that's secure digital flash memory card. Rover TV is available in 3.5-inch and 4-inch versions for $300 and $350, respectively. Rover TV can also download content from TiVo2Go, as well as from iTunes, Burn Lounge, and other online sites. Each model also includes a USB port, AV in and out, and an FM radio tuner. Sooner, announced a beta version for the Mac of its Sooner Remote Computer Access service on Thursday. It lets you use your cell phone to remotely access information from your computer. The basic service, which includes photo and document access and sharing, is free. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup. Our content, as always, is written by the staff at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. Hey, remember that the Podcast and Portable Media Expo is coming up in September. And most importantly, everybody, we got one more week to vote at Podcast Alley. I'm very excited to see what happens by the end of the month. Thanks to all of you who have voted. I really appreciate it. We all really appreciate your supporting the show. Hey, stay subscribed. Until next week, we'll see you online.
And it's a big difference seeing it in all the different pieces and this PDF segments and all that, and then actually having the real book in my hands.
Yeah, I mean, to have like the sheets of paper there, and it has actual weight and everything.
Yeah, and I'm looking through it and I'm going, wow, where'd I find time to write all this?
You looked through it and you said, I wrote that? I am so damn smart.
Yeah. I should have a copy of this book. There's a lot of good stuff in here.
There's all kinds of it. I wish I knew this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. I wrote it.
Oh, wait. Yeah.
Very cool.